Session number 9535, Reel 7.
Mr. George Cole, Reel 7. Why did shells drop short and how often would that happen?
Well, I think the main cause was that when there was an attack on, everything was worked out. The infantry was supposed to go forward so far, see, to their objective, see. Then there was a time lag. Then the artillery would lift and the infantry moved forward, see. But sometimes when they took the objective, easier than what they thought, they went beyond, see. Why, we didn't know that because communication went down, see. Instead of them stopping till they allotted time and then moving forward, they rushed forward, see. Why, the artillery was still firing on the German trenches, see. And they were jumping ahead of the program. And they blamed the artillery. We went firing short. It was them that was in a hurry to get forward.
Would shells ever drop short because there was something wrong with the shell or the cartridge?
Well, I couldn't say that. I'd hardly think that, say. We never experienced it in the normal way. But the bulk of the so-called dropping short or firing short was because the infantry had took the objective earlier than what they expected. And then it went rushing on ahead, say.
So you don't think it was ever because there was something wrong with the shell?
No, it was you. To them, taking the objective easier than what they thought they wanted to take them, see.
What about the life of the guns, gun maintenance? Because I believe they could only be fired, each barrel could only be fired.
That's right. Well, that's all I want to tell you. The method, a battery relieved one, they relieved it, take their own guns and so forth, see. But during the Somme, with the bad conditions, board and that, it was hard work. So a battery relieving another one, left their guns at horse lines, walked up, and they took over the guns that was already in action. And that meant that some guns was doing all the firing, all the work, and others were getting none. Now, it exactly happened at Martinpuist that those guns were firing erratic and they're faulty, so they had to come out. And that was unlucky for us. We had to fetch them out, say. No, we got a job, but I was one of the party detailed off, and we're filling shell holes in the road, what had been left of the road, say, and filling them in rubbish, rubble, bricks, anything to make it possible to get over, say. And this particular day, three of us together, you're just throwing bricks in, anything that'll fill holes in, and Jerry's up to 5'9", just a mouse, never heard it. And I was blown up. But anyway, one fellow was killed, another one had his heel damaged, badly injured, see. And anyway, I saw this chap was dead, see. So I bandaged this chap up. And in fact, we attacked the dressing, because we all carried the field dressing on our coat, see. We took the dead man's bandage off him, see. And the three, and I bandaged him up, and I took him back. About quarter mile, hugged them back to the dressing station, and except for a bit shaken, I was all right. I wasn't wounded, hit nothing, say.
When you say you're blown up, you were just.
I was just blown in the air, and I dropped back into a shell hole somewhere, say. But anyway, I got this chap back to the dressing station and had him over the doctor. Yes. And he asked me if I was. I said, oh, yes, I'm all right. I said, I'm not it, sir, say, but I'm getting a shaking, say. So he said, right, just go back and report your body. I said, very good, sir. So I went back, and I had to go back past that same spot. And my heart was down 50 to the dozen, because it just come on us there what had happened, see. And anyway, I reported back to Captain Sutter. And he says, are you all right in court? I said, oh, I said, I'm all right, sir. I said, I'm getting a shaking, like, see, and tell them what had happened. And... So he said to one officer, he says, give man's up a room, see. So they give a room ration, see. And I remember his words. Now he says, now think on call. He says, that's not your room ration, see. Oh, I says, very good, sir, see. And so later on at night, we used to go for our room, or normal room rations. And I went, and like everybody else, I got old ration. She says, how are you feeling? Oh, I says, I think that's all right now. So I said, I'm getting a bit shaken, you know. So he says, right, oh. And so I got another room ration. And he says, by the way, he says, I run guard tonight. I says, yes, sir, well, I would in the guard every other night. Say. He says, well, tell Sergeant Dinnan, that was old sergeant. He says, tell Sergeant Dinnan, you're not on duty tonight. He says, that's my order, see. I says, very good, sir. So away I went. So when I got back to the gun pit, I tell Sergeant Dinnan, I says, Captain Sutter says, I haven't gone on guard tonight. And of course, he let a bit army slang out and he started to say. Well, I says, that's Captain Sutter's orders, Sergeant, see. He says, I'll say Captain Sutter, I say. So anyway, off he went to say Captain Sutter. And it wasn't long before he come back with his tail between his legs. I says, well, what's the verdict? He says, if you go on guard tonight, he says, I'll be on guard tomorrow night. He says, with no stripes on. In other words, he'd say. So he says, but it's look up when we had a quiet night, say, and I got a night's sleep. And I never had no after effects after that, I said.
When you said you felt shaky, what do you mean?
You cannot describe it, you know. When you think on, you've been there, the three of you, all of a sudden, because you never hear a shell or a bullet that hits you. A lot of people, you see them in pictures about dodging shells and dodging bullets. You cannot dodge, because the shell or the bullet that hits you, you never hear it, because it travels faster than sound, see? And I was... I'll admit I was trembling when I went past that place. Was to think, like, why, only a few minutes since he was alive and he was walking. This tower went in a flash through your mind, you know. But walked off, I say.
So next day that feeling had gone?
It went, said away, see.
Were you back to your normal self, you know?
More or less, yes. Yes, I backed me, you know, never so felt me. And, shortly after that, we were relieved. There was another battery. No, we took the guns out. We had to take them out.
You say that the guns were firing irregularly. What do you mean by that?
Why, the shells, it was in the bore. There was that continuous firing and firing and firing, see. And anyway, the artificer, Sergeant McNabb, he checked and they phoned it. It was regular. Because some guns was doing all the work, other guns was doing nothing. And ours was one that had to go back.
What happened when the barrels, when the bore was going?
Well, I believe they have to go back to Hordens and rebore or something. It has to go right back up the road.
Would it mean that the shells lost accuracy or range?
They're not accurate. It affected the range and so forth, I think. But ours had to go back. And we took them back, a place called Bain Court. And before we went back, it got that bad that the ammunition used to come up on saddles, pack saddles, see? The driver had a horse, and he had eight shells, four on either side on a pack saddle. Then there was four on the driver riding the horse. He had four shells on his horse. And the loss is laden is either 8 or 10. And but what had happened before that, there was wagons abandoned and limbs abandoned on the road, say. And I remember we were going back. We went back to the finish to, was it Corby? Anyway, we had to get our full equipment of wagons up, say. So the salvage team sent up to salvage wagons and bodies and limbers and so forth like that. Well, every one was the same colour, mode. you know, the divisional signs, everything was obliterated, say. Why, all they did when they went up at night, they just, the first one they saw, a wagon body or a limb or so forth, hook up and fetch that back. And I remember they were all lined up. And everyone covered the board. You couldn't make any signs on, painted signs on. And we're all set out there to wash them down, say. Gunners and everybody washed them down. And it was laughable when every division in Canadians wagons and New Zealand wagons and the 55, they're all wish all the cut, you know, there's the signs was clear then, see. And they went and sent the sergeant where he come, he looked. Well, he said, what a bloody sight. And anyway, sent there with the paint pots and the blitter did all them signs, put a one on, see. But, of course, others would do the same thing. But, because everything was mowed, say.
While you were at Martin Preece as a gunner, what would your sort of daily routine be, and your nightly routine? What would you do?
Well, I put the end of the line, because I was qualified gunner. I could do any job on the gun, say. But I let it out after that I'd been in C-253, but I never let on the boat. No, I didn't let on the boat being a singular. But at that time, the start of reorganization through the Casualty, see, and we're normally a 4-gun battery. That was the regular thing, 4 hitting pounders. So they start making them 6-gun batteries. So what they did in our division, they disbanded the 253 brigade, that was the last brigade. They disbanded that and they sent two guns to another battery, other two to another battery, another two and so, see. Where they saved majors, sergeant majors. So you had a major then for 6 guns instead of a major for 4. Sergeant major, so on, they say. It was manpower. And rather remarkable, the section that I'd been in when I was wounded, in C-253, came to 254 to make it up to 6 guns. So I was still in that same battery, see, where all my mates in C-253 was there, they knew me, see, and they knew I'd been a singler, but there was nothing on the boat. So anyway, I kept on as a singler.
So you went back to being a singler then?
No, I kept on as a gunner then, in there, and we went out, and later on we came back to Fleurs. That was our next town in the line.
But what was your daily routine as a gunner? How did you spend the day? What period of duty would you have?
Well,
while you were actually a gunner, not a signaller, because we've done while you were a signaller.
Well, when you're in action, you practically normal job, like 1, 2, 3, 4, except sergeant was the number one, say. Then, if you had a bit of relaxation, you were sandbagging, filling up, making a song and this, that, those things. But there wasn't much rest, like say. But I fell in just as hard as I could. And then, eventually, as I tell you, I went out and I went to Bean Court. That was where the horse lines was. And after a while, we had to stay there. I remember we got passes off to go to Amiens for a day. But eventually...
What was that like, a day pass to Amiens?
Why, you just went there and looked around and they started going out. There's no amusement there. You're out the line. You're going to lift back. You're going to lift down with an army lorry and catch your thumb and lift back with another one.
Would you go to the French cafes or...?
Yeah, I can't. You're in the cafes and fellas used to get the Stammies. That's the name for the public. It was the Stammies. You had a day out, say. And,
would you do much drinking or...?
They didn't drink, but I remember you said vin blanc, that's white wine, or vin rouge, red wine. What was it? There's another zinc, citron, a sweet drink, see. But I was never a boozer, like they say. You said that. But anyway, from Bain Court, I went back into the line, I went to Fleurs. And I believe I've told you before that when the meeting Sergeant Dawson, when he recognised it, he put that down, say. And we were at Fleurs there. We were there over the Christmas. And we had a... When at that Christmas, There was a ration of Christmas pudding sent out and so forth. And the officers bought some wine among the troops, you know. And I've often thought about it. The men at the wagon mines, those lines, they sacrificed their Christmas pudding so we would have a double ration over the guns. And they sent that up and we have an extra from them, say. And we were in flares just off and on.
Was there any other sort of celebration at Christmas?
It was just another day, like, see. And I remember the Major Palmida, him and one of the officers, they came round and they shook hands and all, and they started laughing and saying, wish you happy Christmas and in all their own bunk. But, and we got an extra rum ration.
Were you doing any firing?
Yes, I fired. It was same as near 15. We did firing, and I think the idea was stop any armistice again. You know, see. But that went on, and at one at Fleurs, there's one particular thing that used to happen every day. The New Zealanders was on our right, eh? And just as it got dusk each day, there used to be a string of horses, pack saddles on, the New Zealanders. And they used to come up, there was an NCO, somebody in charge, in, riding on front on a horse. And there'd be about 10 or 12 horses of pack saddles. They went at passenger one another, just following on. And then at the rear, there was another NCO, somebody in charge. And it was amazing, them horses used to come up every day. And they used to threaten their way through shallows, going on, until they got into the centre, what had been the centre of Fleurs village. That was only a matter of rubbish, see. But they used to get in the centre, and there was a working party from the trenches, lifting the sandbags off, the ammunition off, and whatever they were carrying, put them down. And the horses' armies never stopped, and then it turned around, and away they come past all the bones, and we had every night. And it was marvellous. If Jerry started shelling, the horses never seemed to worry. They just walked so there. It was a marvellous sight to see them horses. And they did that regular every night when it was getting dusk. So the Jerry couldn't observe them, you know. Say.
Would your battery as 18 pounders, would you ever engage in counter battery work, or were you always firing at the front line?
Well, it was just more or less on the trenches and any targets that were opposite saw forward.
You wouldn't have the range to reach the Germans?
No. Their guns was more or less out of all range, see.
Did you get any fire from German heavy artillery?
Yes, and there were 5.9. The Germans had their 5.9 howitzer. And that was the deadliest shell, as far as we were concerned, that was the deadliest shell the Germans had.
That's what they would use to fire on
our guns? On us, on counter battery work, see.
Did you get caught at any of these places in 1960? Did you get much counter battery fire against you?
Well, we didn't. We got them because Jerry was same as us, that they was trying to spot our batteries and we were trying to spot theirs, see. And but the 5.9 German gun, that was the one did the most destruction to all of us, see.
Would you get many shells land near you, your battery position, or was it just a sort of searching effect that get the odd one?
It was a custom, like if we've got any shell, if you got a lot of shell fire on you, you knew that Johnny had spotted you, well, the wiser thing was shifted. Because at one time when we were at Arras, though that was late, they say.
Oh, we'll come to that then. Okay. Uh-huh. So what happened after Christmas then?
After Christmas, the moon was still there, and then the thaw set in. No, the frost set in, say, and everything got frozen. And that lasted till I believe into February. Everything that was it was a blessing in a way, I say, because everything was hard. It was cold, but still it was very hard. And I remember after the move, when it flares, we'll move the guns forward, about 15 or 20 yards, a bit drier ground. And we'll haul the guns forward, got a better gun pitch for them, say. And we had a sergeant, he was killed at Dallas, Sergeant Billy Wallace, and we're tussling in over the guns, and pulling them. And eventually we got them up to the spot where they had to go, see. Then we had the ammunition of the ship, see, where the ground was all frozen hard then, see. You know, carrying them up, four shells. There was a clip on the bottom of the 18 pounder, and you could carry two in each hand, you see. And somebody, one of the wise lads, says, let's skim them across the bottom, see. So, skim them along the hard bottom, instead of carrying them, you know. One officer's caught me, played all the air. And, but what would happen is, oh, I said, they're not happening, sir. I said, they're our dudes, because they'll get to look at them. And we'll skin them with each other across the bottoms instead of carrying them.
You said you were getting a lot of duds. Did you mean
that? Yes.
What was a dud shell then?
Well, the shell went off and it didn't explode. It didn't know it was a dud. And I'll tell you the thing that happened at Flores and all one time. I was mates with a fellow called Billy Brown. He belonged to your cousin. And when he used to descend the guard, we never called it sentry, guard, see. And Billy and me used to nearly always fall together, see. And so this night we were on, and there was a certain shell I got and a type of fuse. There was a brass cover on, and before you fired, you put your finger in the little ring and clip it off and throw that away. It was to keep the moisture out, don't lose anything. And what we used to do on a night, we used to go on night firing, and you used to fire so many shells, and you couldn't see, but it had been roads, bridges, and other places had been registered on, you see. And it was just the idea of maybe it's catching somebody at a party during the night, see. Jerry did the same thing with us, eh? So I said to Billy, I says, I wonder what the sound like if this went out with this on. He says, we stood talking and laughing now, because nobody heard us. All you had to do was find them shells during the night. This sort of car is here, you'd fire 20 shells, that all matters, see. You'd get rid of them. I says, we'll try it out, see. So we loaded one up, and we put extra range on, cocked the one up, put extra range on so it wouldn't drop short, see. And it loads up, and Billy went outside, stood outside the gun pit. Of course, he was clear of the blast and everything, see. So right over, that's the way it built, so firing off it went, see. And anyway, he come back. And he's laughing all, I says, what's it like? When he said, that bugger doesn't kill them, it will frighten them to death. It was going like a siren, because this ring on was flying around, and it was making a noise like a siren. He said, go on over and listen, see. So anyway, I went over, and he fired a war, see. And away it went. He went off the noise, see. And I remember saying, if that bugger doesn't kill them, it will frighten them to death. And when you're firing, we used to put extra range on, you know. Of course, it didn't matter. Nobody knew. We used to cock the muzzle up and get extreme range on. And away they went there, see. And we did all sorts of things. We got rid of the shells. The Germans used to do the same thing, you know, see. And
what other things did you try?
Why? Because there's one night we'll find like that, and I says, we'll put the extreme range on, Billy. He says, aye. So I believe it was 6,800 yards. That was our extreme range, see? So cook the range, like with the anti-aircraft gun, and off it went, see? And I says, the Gambion, I says, if that drops in ops, the squatters, I says, and the Rudy Kaiser and Hindenburg there. Just, you know, he says, I say, we won't win it. But we never know what happened to him, Arthur. And Jerry did the same, and he did the same. We used to get odd shares at night. You say, oh, drop me out, you know, see. We saw me on the day in the DAP thing the same way, you know, see. And while we were there, I think it was before Christmas, Billy says that he was expecting a parcel. Well, over what they call the back of the office, where the officers was, there'd be about 50 or 60 yards behind the goal, say. And he was expecting his parcel. And he said, I wouldn't take a bloody fortune to go over there, because you could get lost in the mould and slush and everything, say. I says, well, I'll tell you, I'll go over and Billy say, if your parcel's there, I says, there might be a letter for me or something like that, see? He says, right on. So I went across and there's a look up and his parcel was there and I had a letter. And he was telling me before I got the parcel, he says, there's a bottle of whiskey in there. I says, is that? He says, aye. So anyway, I went across and I got the parcel. And Billy May sat there and Billy opened his parcel. I got my letter and read it and Billy's opened his parcel. He's put this there and put there. And I remember the little loaf of bread wrapped up and put that to one side. There's no bottle of whiskey, see. And, I says, and he whiskey. He says, Abrano. So he got the loaf of bread, undid it, unwrapped it, and then he pulled it. And his wife, or whoever they were, they'd got this small loaf of bread, they'd cut the white out, the inside, and put this half a bottle of whiskey in there, and then put the two halves of the loaf of bread together. The bread, the remainder loaf, was a cushion for the bottle of whiskies. So Billy and Men always just keep that dark, see? I says, right, oh. And each night, Billy and May had a drop of tea made and a drop of whiskey in there for their nightcap, see. And I says to Billy, I says, and I was sweating on my leave, see. I says, Billy, I says, if I get my leave, I says, I tell her a day. He says, what? I says, I'll fetch you a bottle of whiskey back, I says, to compensate you for that. Oh, I says, yes, I says, I will. And when I got to Barnsley, I got my leave. I got a bottle of whiskey, and my father took it to the pub, and I took it back to Billy. We were at Harris then, and I took it back to Billy. And I never got a drink of it. I didn't want to one, see. I fancy for it, see. But that's how I got a bottle of whiskey at Fleur's.